Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mark Perry, an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies, and his latest book just out is The Pentagon Wars. And he has an article at Politico, Are Trump's Generals In Over Their Heads? And another at The American Conservative, How Saddam Hussein Predicted America's Failure in Iraq, which is, I believe, a part of the Pentagon Wars book, is it not?
Yes, that's right. It's an excerpt from a chapter of the book.
So where do we start, Mark? I mean, let me start with the Military Times just had a poll that came out, I think, yesterday, saying that 53% of serving U.S. military officers do not support their commander-in-chief, Donald Trump.
Yeah, I was surprised by the number. I'm not surprised that that's a general feeling, but I thought the number would probably be still in the 40s, which is what I looked at last time. And the answer is very simple. I don't think this is a character issue. I don't think it's a tweet issue. I think that what the rank and file, the enlisted personnel in the military are disturbed about are the continuing serial deployments of American forces overseas. You know, it's like any other institution. It gets tired. And we've been 16 years in Afghanistan. There's very little faith among the military, even the senior military, that we can somehow win and perhaps not even draw. We're still in Iraq. We're now in Syria. And we just had four of our American soldiers killed in Niger. And I think that what this poll shows is a general across-the-board exhaustion with these wars among the military. After all, they voted 80% for Trump because they supported his view that the United States military should not be involved in nation building. And lo and behold, they think, here we are again.
Well, it's particularly ironic, is it not, though, that General Kelly is now embroiled in a political scandal where he went to Trump's rescue and he effectively got slimed. But the fact that John Kelly, the Marine general, lost his son in Afghanistan, and that became an issue in this to and fro about the disrespect or the alleged disrespect that the president paid towards the widow of the slain Green Beret from Niger. How much does that pay? You say that the military are tired of deployments, but they must also be wondering, what the hell was this war in Afghanistan all about, America's longest war? And what were the sacrifices worth? You know, what do we have to show for it?
Well, General Kelly is a throwback. He's a very deeply conservative, social conservative person. He was a great combat officer and one of the best. And it's right to honor his service. But as they say in the military, he's out of his lane. He has 4 years of experience being a combat infantry officer and absolutely zero in doing what he has to do, which is to organize the president's schedule, be political, glad hand with members of Congress, speak to the press openly and fairly, watch his language. I mean, can you imagine what would have happened if Leon Panetta, for instance, had given that briefing? We would not be here now. It's just a case of, here is a military officer who's not trained to do what he's doing now. And I think it's showing. He's, you know, he's a throwback. He's a dyed-in-the-wool Marine, and they have definite opinions, and they're never afraid to express them, no matter how conservative they are. And that's not good politics. So I think he made a mistake, and it shows.
But do you think that liberals made a mistake in thinking that because there's some adult supervision, as Senator Corker describes it, having these generals containing Trump, that liberals somehow thought because Kelly was doing what was needed, he was therefore one of them, when in fact, as you point out, he's deeply conservative. He may have a lot more in common with Trump's policies than people realize.
Well, I think you're exactly right, but there were a lot of us in the press who, looking over our shoulder, wondering why everyone was applauding this man. I mean, listen, he's a perfectly fine man, but he's just not cut out for this job. I think that progressives were hoping that, you know, adult supervision would kick in, And what they're finding out is that, you know, these military officers, Mattis, McMaster, and Kelly, have just as many blemishes, though perhaps not as deeply ensconced as our commander-in-chief. And it's quite a surprise to a lot of people. You know, I'd hate to say it, but after the Kelly press conference, it appears that the people in charge of the daycare center, as Senator Corker would say, probably need some daycare themselves. They're just not that sophisticated politically. And I suspect, and I think that this is largely what you're getting at, they're a little out of step with the enlisted personnel, the privates, corporals, and sergeants in the military, who are a little bit more fed up than they are with these wars. And I think that begins to take its toll.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Perry, who's an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies, and his latest book just out is The Pentagon Wars. He has an article at Politico, Are Trump's Generals In Over Their Heads?, and another at the American Conservative, How Saddam Hussein Predicted America's Failure in Iraq. Let's turn to that article, which is a chapter in your new book, Mark Perry, The Pentagon Wars. It just is, at this point, the Iraq situation is the gift that keeps on not giving, yeah. but bleeding. You know, it's just the open wound. It just seems like no end in sight, and it just gets worse and worse. And now, with the Iranian-backed militias taking Kirkuk, they've basically taken the economic lifeline away from Iraqi Kurdistan, where the U.S. has found that the Iraqi Kurds and the Syrian Kurds are the only boots on the ground that have been of any use in the war against the Islamic State. And this is obviously yet another victory for Iran. My understanding with Saddam Hussein was one of the reasons he simply up to the very end didn't believe the Americans were going to invade, because he couldn't believe they'd be that stupid, because if you get rid of me, it's a gift to the Iranians. But somehow that message never got through to our people.
Well, you're exactly right. And I can recall in 2006, 2007, when we were at the height of our troubles in Iraq, which, as you point out, have continued, I was talking to a very senior Pentagon official aide to Donald Rumsfeld. He was at lunch with me, kind of giving me a briefing on what was happening in Anbar, the western province of Iraq, which was a mess. And I turned to him and I said, "You mean to tell me we're losing?" And he said, "I'm not only telling you we're losing, we're on the wrong side." And I thought, holy cow, that's an incredible mistake. And you're right, it is a mistake that keeps on giving. And Saddam Hussein just didn't think we were going to come and get him, precisely because of the Iranian threat. Well, here we are. I understand that our government believes that Iran is a threat, but I think it's an exaggeration to say, as many do, as we're all inclined to believe, that we kind of turned Iraq over to the Iranians. These are quite different people. The Iraqis are Shias like the Iranians, but they're Arabs. And sooner or later, and perhaps sooner than we think, they're going to ask the Iranians to leave. And if they don't leave, they're going to fight them. Now, you know, do we want to get in the middle of that one, as we've gotten in the middle of everything else in the Middle East? It just doesn't pay. It's not our fight. It's not our fault, and frankly, we can't fix it. So I think that the drumbeat that you're going to begin hearing from the military is, it's time to end these wars, and it's time to retool our diplomacy and think very clearly about what the nation's priorities are.
But it seems, though, even though the Saudis and the Iraqi government of Abadi apparently are starting to talk, and that this is something that Tillerson managed to broker, it does seem, though, that both the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and the young, impetuous boy king, MBS, in Saudi Arabia, it's almost as if they want the Americans to go and fight and die in a war against Iran at their behest.
Well, you know, having had me on before and having read, you know, my work, how I feel about that. It could be that we have a president who's willing to bite that off or to try to digest that. But I think that cooler heads around him will prevail. Now, Secretary James Mattis, a four-star Marine, retired, doesn't like Iran, not even a little bit. and has consistently called them a malign influence in the Middle East. But I get no sense from him, and I don't hear anything from those around him that he actually wants to take them on militarily and believes doing so would be foolish. So the question is, you know, with Netanyahu and, as you say, the young and impetuous MBS, who is Trump going to listen to? Is he going to listen to Jim Mattis, or is he going to listen to those who are beating the drums of war? My hope is that he lives, that he leans on and learns from and listens to Jim Mattis. So far, so good, but we're only at the beginning of this process.
But isn't there a bit of a wild card there with having Eric Prince and his mercenary army in the Emirates? I know they're mostly doing contract work for the Chinese, but Bannon, of course, is no longer in the White House, but he's certainly proving to be a real thorn in the side of the so-called Republican establishment. And it's hard to know whether Trump is behind him or not. It's more and more appears that Trump's actually
listening to him.
Exactly, and they have some kind of wag the tail type of relationship. But it wouldn't take much to spark a war in that region. The IRGC and their speedboats, they're a bunch of nutcases. And, you know, you get a little bit of a shootout going with them in the Straits of Hormuz. A couple of tankers get sunk. And then we got a massive global catastrophe on our hands, right?
Well, you've put your finger on it. I think that, we're unfortunately on a hair trigger. I keep waiting for us to draw back a little bit for the adults in the room, as they call them, to kind of calm things down. It never quite seems to happen. I think that an accidental confrontation between Iran and the United States is actually much more dangerous than what's happening in North Korea. I could be wrong, but I think that we're headed that way unless we take some very significant steps to head it off.
Well, that's really saying something, because just the other day I spoke with Ambassador Donald Gregg, who used to be the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, and he was George H.W. Bush's national security advisor when he was vice president under Reagan. And he's absolutely alarmed about the situation in North Korea. He talks to the North Koreans and says you can talk to them. He doesn't understand why our side doesn't talk to them. But he said, I'm more afraid of Donald Trump than I am of Kim Jong-un. So, you know, that's a pretty volatile situation. So to say that you think the situation with Iran is even worse, that's really something.
I think that the chance of a kind of accidental confrontation is quite possible. That's what worries me. And we have boots on the ground in Iraq, and they're extremely vulnerable. They're outnumbered by the Iranians, and we have our Navy in the Persian Gulf. I mean, it is a very dangerous situation. And the rhetoric that is coming out of this administration isn't helping. It hasn't been, we haven't been paying as much attention as Korea. But I think that the rhetoric is as alarming on Iran as it is on Korea. And I'm very worried. I think it's, I give it 50-50, which I think is, you know, is way higher than it should be. But it's about 50-50 that there will be some kind of a confrontation. And we have a trigger puller in the Oval Office, in my opinion, who's not inclined to listen to cooler heads, and that's a very deep problem.
Well, what do you think's going to happen, though, with the Kurds? I mean, they've been sold out a number of times. Henry Kissinger and the Shah sold them out. But they've proven to be the only reliable boots on the ground that the U.S. could find to fight the Islamic State. The Islamic State's now being rolled up both in Iraq and in Syria, where the Syrian Kurds are doing the heavy lifting. It looks as though now that they've lost their economic viability because they've lost Kirkuk, they've got tremendous hostility coming from Erdogan in Turkey, hostility from the Iranians they share a border with in the east. Now Baghdad's angry with them. I know that the Israelis have made enormous military and intelligence investments in Kurdistan. It looks like it's pretty shaky for the long term, even the short term.
It does look shaky, but I'm not a pessimist on the Kurdish issue. And the reason I'm not a pessimist is, unlike with Iran and unlike with North Korea, we have direct communications with them. And we've made our views known. And we know their leadership quite well. We have very good lines of communication into the Iraqi government. And we have a Secretary of State. Well, I know a lot of people are very skeptical of him. I think he's actually doing a very good job on this issue, who's trying to calm the tempers and roll back the rhetoric and make the American point of view here very well known. We would like Iraq to remain a single country. Now, that doesn't mean we're against Kurdish rights. We're not. There is a negotiated settlement here between the Kurds and the Baghdad government that is quite doable. And if we work a little hard on it, we could get it. And it would be acceptable to the Kurds. They have been good, strong allies. And we've depended on them in many places in the Middle East. We've helped them a lot, actually. We've had a mixed history with them, but recently we've helped them a lot, and they're inclined to listen to us. And I think that that's all to the good. I think that the wild card here is Israel, because there's no question that their prime minister wants to pick a fight with the Iranians, and the one way to do that is to get the Kurds on side and to bang the table and say, Kurdish independence, and because the Iranians oppose it. Well, the Iranians do oppose it, but so should we. I think an autonomous area inside Iraq with guaranteed rights is probably the way to go on this, and I think we can accomplish that.
Well, that's what they had, but now they lost their economic viability by losing Kirkuk, and now the Turks are cutting off the pipeline, so... We should have weighed in earlier and advised them not to have this referendum.
Well, from your mouth to policymakers' ears, I agree with you. Mm. We should have weighed in earlier, but we've made our views on this known. Mm-hmm. Yes, they've lost Kirkuk, but the oil revenues from Kirkuk are quite negotiable. They've been causing problems in Turkey, and Turkey has been causing a lot of problems for them. That's quite negotiable if we maintain on side with Turkey and maintain good relations with Erdogan. This is much more of a diplomatic problem. I can't think of one instance in which the United States could solve this militarily. We're always reaching for the hammer. In this case, this incipient conflict can be resolved diplomatically, and I think that's the preference of all sides.
Well, just in closing, Mark Perry, with a president that is impetuous and ignorant, and you say he's got a hair trigger, and he's certainly influenced by Netanyahu, not to mention Stephen Bannon and his buddy Eric Prince with his mercenary army, on top of that, you've got to look at the larceny going on, you know, with the Saudis bribing Jared and Ivanka. They gave her $100 million. And God knows what kind of financial arrangements are going on with Trump. He seems to be, his foreign policy is predicated upon which third world dictator he can shake down for money and build hotels. I mean, that's a big element. It's not just geopolitics. It's the Trump family business involved in all of this stuff.
Well, I want to be clear. I agree that we are in a very dicey situation and that American leadership is lacking. We've been lucky as a country. We've had good leaders, Washington and Lincoln and Roosevelt and Eisenhower. We've had good, and Reagan. We've had good leaders when we needed them, and now we don't. And this is going to be really difficult. And we could be facing a domestic, and I think we are facing a domestic crisis, where we're going to have to figure out a way to remove the president. And this situation could get much, much worse. I think that the hope is that we've gotten through tough situations before, and that we're now starting to see a realization on the part of leaders in the Senate, at least, who are willing to take this on. It's just the beginning. We've got a long ways to go. We don't have much time, but it's a beginning. And, I remain pessimistic about the short term, but in the long term, let's hope that the adults prevail.
Well, Mark Perry, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Perry. He's an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. And his latest book just out is The Pentagon Wars. And he has an article at Politico, Are Trump's Generals in Over Their Heads? And another at The American Conservative, How Saddam Hussein Predicted America's Failure in Iraq. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into a country that most Americans just learned the U.S. military is involved in, Niger.